Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM, the Sunday night special where we get someone to pick the tracks. And my guest tonight, I'm glad to say, is the writer Nicole Flattery. Nicole, great to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And Nicole, I should just say, Nicole's book, before we get started, your book, Show Them a Good Time, is a collection of short stories, which originally came out on Stinging Fly.
Yeah.
And since that, there's more books on the way, and we'll talk about that as time goes on. Yeah. But I'm going to go on very little other than when I have a guest coming in, I do my homework, do a bit of research. and I thought, just for this purposes, because the first thing that came up was an interview with you in the Westmeath Examiner. And I thought, well, I'll just use that as I'll just base everything. I'll base everything on this.
Oh, OK.
It begins, as Westmeath continues to establish itself as a big league supplier of talent to the world of, to the world of arts and literature. The latest candidate to emerge in the county's colours is Kinnegad-born writer Nicole Flattery. Nicole, is Westmeath a big league supplier of talent to the worlds of arts and literature?
I feel now really ashamed I didn't pick a Joe Dolan song. And I really should have.
Apart from Joe, God bless him. No, it's great. It's great when the local paper gets behind you.
Yeah. It was a very enthusiastic interview. I remember doing it. And yeah, I was very pleased with it.
Now, on page four of your book, this is how forensic this program is. On page four of your book, in the first story,
yeah,
which is the title story, Show Them a Good Time, it says, "Before the garage, my hometown was famous amongst people with car sickness. It was here they stood retching and spewing before moving on somewhere better."
Mm.
Kinnegad was, to a lot of people, was a bit of a blockage in the road for a long time, wasn't it?
You know, that's a sort of, someone asked me recently if that was based on Kinnegad, but no, not really. It's just imaginative reach.
It's a strange coincidence.
It is a coincidence.
All right. Well, we'll talk about Kinnegad and everything else in just a moment, Nicole. Your first choice is Sharon Van Etten, which is a fine choice. What do you want to hear from Sharon?
I would like to hear the song 17, which is from her most recent album. That's my favourite song of hers. I saw her recently. She played Dublin.
Yeah.
She played Vicar Street in, a few months ago.
Yeah.
But she was great. I'm a huge fan.
Van Etten. And that's Sharon Van Etten and a song called 17. The first choice tonight of my guest, Nicole Flattery, the author of Show 'Em a Good Time, a collection of really excellent short stories. Nicole's with me tonight. Well, if you've just joined us, we've established the fact that Nicole comes from Kinnegad. And we've established the fact that the first reference to a town on the road on page four, most famous amongst people with car sickness, it was here they stood wretched, is not a reference to Kinnegad. It's one of the things about your stories, though, Nicole, you don't specifically locate them anywhere, as far as I can tell, throughout the whole book.
Yeah. I think that there is, you know, quite like obvious references, like in the longest story in the book, you probably know it's a college in Dublin.
Yeah, but you don't use street names, place names, townland names, nothing like that.
No, I don't. I feel that's because, like, generally when I'm starting to write something, it usually comes from voice. I don't really specifically write from place. Mm. And then, you know, small towns in Ireland, which I write about a lot, they just seem homogenous to me in some kind of way. So, yeah, I don't generally write from place. Although I was just saying to you, I did write something quite recently, sat in London, where I did name places, and I found that useful to me for what's.
It's kind of odd because when, particularly, you know, you read the first story, and at the end of it, I started thinking, "Hang on a minute, where was this?
Yeah.
What period are we in? Mm. It's quite, you have to go back and figure out, even is it in the future? it might have been.
I think if when I'm writing, I'm kind of, I write sort of abstractly and I'm looking for a tone that would sort of unnerving. And I think if you don't name everything, if you're not specific about everything, you can get there like much quicker.
And is this a technique or an approach that you had on yourself, or had you come across this somewhere else?
No, I remember when I was starting to write when I was quite younger, being quite reluctant to name anything. I wonder why that is. So I don't get in trouble, maybe.
Possibly. Most people just change the names, I would imagine it would cause you, it hasn't caused you any, I would imagine it would cause difficulties to leave out the names of places and towns and so on, just to help you write it, actually. Mm. But then you've got the place in your head, don't you?
Yeah, I have it's in my mind pretty clearly.
And is that place ever Kinnegad?
Then that particular story that we read there, there's a petrol station.
Yeah.
Set in a petrol station. And I had the petrol station in my mind, which is a petrol station that you come, like it's the first one you meet when you come to Kinnegad, because my sister used to work there when I was a child and she was about 15. And I thought it was a really cool job and I wanted to work at a petrol station. And I just always was in my mind because I understood that world really easily because I was always there. So, yeah.
Although it's not the same petrol station, we ought to stress. Think of anybody, any bus to read them. I'm going to continue with the Westmeath Examiner here.
Oh,
we've already gone through Westmeath being claimed here as a big league supplier of talent to the worlds of arts and literature. Okay, now you created a lot of excitement in the literary press. It says here when it was this. I love the local press for this because they love this, that the internationally known publishing house Bloomsbury,
internationally known,
had agreed to a 2-book deal. We're not going to get into the vulgarities, but for a hefty sum as well. So, I mean, I want to congratulate you for that.
Thank
first.
You.
But how has that affected your writing? Because you're kind of, I know you've been writing for a long time, but the Stinging Fly collection of short stories get you up and running.
Yeah.
You get some traction. And then suddenly the world moves, everything shifts. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Has it shifted in a way that's not necessarily perfect either? Mm. I mean, too much too soon or any of those sorts of ideas going through your head?
definitely. Like, I feel that, one thing it's done, it's given me, just because of things I've had to do in promoting the book less time. Like before, I had a lot of time, which is what you need when you're writing. Mm. So now it's kind of more within a tighter time frame. And also, you suddenly have like a lot more people's voices in your head. Like I have like critics' voices and...
Well, ignore them.
Westmeath Examiner's voices. They're very supportive.
Don't ignore the Westmeath Examiner, whatever you do. But for instance, when you write that first book, I mean, will you tell me what the circumstances were? I guess, did you just send a story to the Stinging Fly? And, as lots of people do, and it got published and then they took an interest, I guess.
I had my first story, Hump, published in the Stinging Fly. Then I worked on a couple more. And then I won the White Review Prize and then Declan offered to do the collection. I guess I was writing a lot in my 20s and, came from a place that was like quite broke and, quite dissatisfied. There's a lot about work in the book and quite dissatisfied with like the idea of work, which was, it's totally changed for my generation. And I think it came from a lot of that kind of anger and stuff. And I now I'm in a different position. So I'm writing from somewhere kind of different, which is new and like exciting, but I'm not driven in the same way that I would have been probably in my 20s,
And there are also people waiting for it.
Yeah.
Not least the people who have given you the hefty sum.
Refreshing their emails.
To go and write the thing.
Yeah.
But it's a very changed circumstance. I mean, it seems ideal in a way. Mm. Most writers dream of that. They after their first book, the big guys swoop in and offer you money. But it's not perfect either in lots of ways.
No, it's not perfect. And I think the most important thing to do is probably just forget about that and write for yourself, like as you've always kind of, as I've always kind of done.
And where are you at with that?
Yeah, good. I'm taking along. I feel okay.
It's only two books.
It's only two. Nothing to panic about.
No pressure. By the way, before we go any further, your name Flattery.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that common a name.
No.
Is it a version of O'Flaherty or something?
I don't know. I started thinking, I never really thought about my surname until this year. Right. And every single like subheading or whatever was like a pun.
Of course.
And on my surname. And then there was one book review that like made four different jokes on my second name. And I was like, oh my God, they're having so much fun with this. But yeah, I don't know where it comes from. I don't know many things about other flatteries. I'm sure they're out there though.
You should find out. It's a great name. Yeah. Your next track is Saint Sister. Mm. So tell me about this.
Yeah, I think that they're kind of young Irish band. They're two women. I did an event with them at All Together Now, and I think they're just brilliant.
I saw part of that. It was great.
Yeah, it was really good. Just really enjoyed listening to them talk about their work as well and their lyrics. And yeah, I think they're brilliant. So
okay, Saint Sister, and this is called Is It Too Early? Brackets, Kilmainham. Saint Sister there, and Is It Too Early? The choice of Nicole Flattery, who's with me in studio. Nicole, the author of Show Them a Good Time, and two other books which we haven't seen yet, but we will.
One other.
We will. Well, your deal's for two, though, isn't
two.
It?
Two, yeah, it's for that one.
Oh, they're doing that one as well. Oh, so Bloomsbury are going to bring out the short
story.
Yeah, they
have
that.
Oh, they've
got that one out. And then the novel.
Yeah, I was just panicking there. I was like, one other.
Okay, one other. Have you got a title for it yet?
I do, yeah. It's going to be called Nothing Special, hopefully.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah, I'm really setting myself up. I set myself up with this title too.
Yeah. Because
I'm making it easy for critics. I just feel bad for critics.
Paul Brady brought out a sort of a greatest hits album once, and it was called Nobody Knows. It was one of his songs, but the title was Nobody Knows Paul Brady. and he knew what he was doing, you know, but I thought... Eh. Anyway, these things can be used against you.
Yeah.
So you've no idea where the Flattery name comes from.
No.
But you know where you come from yourself.
Yeah, I do.
Which is Kinnegad, even though you don't necessarily declare it very often in the book.
No, right. I don't declare it in the book.
So what did your folks do?
My dad was a teacher. He's retired now. So he was an English teacher at a boys' school in Tullamore. And my mum, also retired, was an accountant.
Oh,
so, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And... books in the house?
Yeah, a lot of books in the house. So me and my sister, I just have one older sister, big readers. My dad was a person who like encouraged that and brought us to the library and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, very bookish house. My mother doesn't really read, but the rest. Yeah, no, she doesn't. She doesn't have the patience for it, I don't think. But the three of us would have been.
So. And when your dad's an English teacher, does that mean that when you go to the library, he's kind of directing you as to what to take out?
No, he never directed me, but he often let me take books out from the adult section before my time. Yeah. And that was nice. I appreciated that.
He'd have known what they were, though.
Yeah, like Stephen King and stuff. And because my sister was 5 years older than me, I wanted to read what she was reading. That was really my only goal. So like when she went up to like the young adult section of the library, that's what I also wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I think I like kicked up a fuss and I got to go early.
and did you make sense? Of course, when you're talking about young adult books or adult books, you're talking about Stephen King, really, aren't
you?
Yeah, that kind of stuff. Because sometimes kids want to read the grown-up books and there's no point because they won't understand what's going on in them.
Yeah, and I don't get that. There's real, like, all those books I read as a teenager, you know, it's still a real pleasure to be derived from reading the right book at the right time.
Were you a big Stephen King fan? Yeah.
I was, yeah. I was just thinking about that because I saw the new It film. But I was a massive fan. I read Carrie at, like, just the right age, I think. Yeah, and The Shining and all those.
He sure knows how to write a story, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. And then he kind of tapers off towards the end, I always feel. But yeah, I was big into them. And I was like into all the kind of like Sweet Valley High, like anything my sister was reading, I was also reading. So I could, you know, engage with her about that.
and what were your favorite? I mean, apart from Stephen King and that kind of thing, were you reading any of the books that your dad might have been teaching, say, at school? Were you reading any of the classics or that sort of thing?
No, but he always made us made us read a lot of poetry. So if he was like teaching poetry, and he taught a lot, Leaving Cert, generally, we would have read poetry with him and stuff like that. But he never made me read anything that was like essential to me.
Now, what are the circumstances? You said make you read and read with him. So what would happen? Because it was all gathered around now. We're going to have. We're going to have.
God, you have a very romantic. It's a very romantic image. No way.
Have some poetry.
Yeah. No.
How would that happen?
He would just like suggest like certain poems for us to read. I remember reading like Midterm Break and things like that when I was like quite young, and it was a good, good, useful thing to have, and it was great. I remember from my Leaving Cert when I did Macbeth, because he taught Macbeth for so long. He knew it like off by heart, essentially. So he was a great person to have around.
And of course, I'm assuming that, like most places, he taught in a boys' school, so therefore he didn't teach you.
No, no, he didn't.
Yeah, I'd say that would be tricky, though.
Thank God.
Now, according to the Westmeath Examiner, to return to it again, you went to St. Etchan's National
Primary
School.
Yeah.
You don't know who the Flatterys are. You probably don't know who St. Etchan is.
No.
I've never come across St. Etchan before. No.
Really?
Forgive me, people of
Westmeath. I can look into that if that need, like, I can.
There could be a whole novel in St. Etchan. there might be. And then you went to Loretto and Mullingar.
Yeah, it's a girls' school. So, yeah.
Your next choice, Nicole, is Amy Winehouse.
It is indeed. I guess I love this song from. Just it reminds me of like actually kind of being in school and like being like 17, 18. And she was such a cultural icon at that time. So
very grown up though, Amy Winehouse.
She was, I saw her at Oxygen when I was like, Oxygen, God. And like when I was like 18, it's imprinted on my memory. But
And so. You know, when you're that, I mean, I know kids are much more advanced and intelligent than we would have been at that age, but the content of that Amy Winehouse album is very adult.
Yeah, I'm very dark, and I don't think I properly understood it at like 17, 18, or like what she kind of like symbolized or anything about her really until, you know, a couple of years later, and I would have been reading about her and watched the documentary and kind of, you know, witnessing firsthand like the destruction of a woman in that kind of respect was, you know, but not like processing it and then reading it all later and just realizing kind of how horrible it was and how badly she was treated, you know.
Huge talent.
Yeah.
Incredible. Back to black. Amy Winehouse, bless her, Back to Black, the choice of Nicole Flattery, who's with me in studio. So when did you start writing your own stuff?
I always wrote kind of on and off in school, and I was very into like the creative side of things even then.
Apart from what you were being told to write, you know?
Yeah, like I would have written stories and things like that.
Of your own?
And then I kind of stopped in college. I guess because I was studying, I studied theatre and film, and I was reading a lot of theory and things, and you know, you're in college and you're just distracted by like 100 other things.
But when you're still at school, what do you think looking back your motivation was in writing stories? That you didn't have to write, you know, you could have been doing a million other things.
I know, and it's funny kind of because I'm going to give an answer that doesn't like necessarily, I've been thinking about this, like, you know, you kind of think about this. Like in your darker times when you're writing a book and like everything's, you're like, why am I doing this? Like what encouraged me to do this in the first place? But I was always really good at it. Like that was the one thing that like, when I wasn't like good at sports or anything, I was really good at English all through like primary school and like secondary school. And I liked being good at something.
Yeah.
So that was the thing.
And I'm not, it's not that I want to leave your mother out of the conversation, but your dad being the English teacher, were you showing them to him?
Yeah. And he read all those, like all of them. And he would also, when he was teaching, and bring home like any good short stories he got in his class and be like, you should read this. And this boy wrote this. And that was interesting, I always felt. But yeah, so then I kind of stopped when I was in college. I didn't really think about writing. And to my fault, I don't think I was reading very much. And I felt sort of like dissatisfied. But I didn't really know why. I wasn't studying English, so I never, like, I just kind of forgot about it. And then in third year of college, I did a playwriting module, and it was very encouraging and good. And I remember I enjoyed it. And then I did an advanced...
Well, here, I want to take come to the college, but But just on that of showing these stories to your dad and him showing you stories by boys you might have known or maybe not known in the boys' school, that would to some extent have removed what would normally be there for any person writing stories. Mm. You know, it would remove some of the isolation, I guess. You know, you're not entirely doing it on your own.
Yeah.
That might have made a difference.
But even seeing these things when, like, you know, a short story written by the 17-year-old when I was like 13, you know, is encouraging and is something you can do. And for that reason, I think I never thought of English as like a academic sort of subject. It was the only subject that I really enjoyed. And I saw there was always a creative element to it, you know.
And were you conscious of what the short story was as a form or anything, or were you just writing literally short stories, if you know what I mean?
No, I didn't know anything, although I had read Frank O'Connor, but I didn't know anything about the short story. I had read a couple, but I had no idea about like the ideas around it or anything.
Mind you, if you've read Frank O'Connor, you know.
Frank O'Connor, yeah.
If you've absorbed that, you're well on the road, I'd say. So, you were good at English, but were you good at anything else?
No.
Sorry, that sounded like a very rude question. I didn't mean it that way.
I wasn't. I was good at history, which was just an extension of English. I was good at any kind of like academic type, like Englishy type thing, and I was terrible at like maths.
Right.
So anything with numbers, I'm not good at.
Central casting here.
Yeah.
Sport?
Oh God, no, dreadful. I played basketball, but like only because I was tall-ish for my age.
Again, central casting. Very unhappy, yeah.
Oh, miserable.
You don't give me. I mean, I didn't know you then, but you don't give the impression that you were that kind of goth teenager.
Oh no, I wasn't a goth. Definitely not. Want to clear that up on the radio. Yeah. but I was a little awkward and unsure of myself, as any teenage girl kind of is, you know.
And teenager in Kinnegad, what's that like?
It was just one street, so just kind of, you know, we go for a lot of walks and sit in a lot of walls and. Yeah, that was like the extent of it.
There's a great account in your book there of, you know, new families and therefore new boys moving into houses nearby.
Yeah, you were always very aware of when the new boys moved in, you know.
And the preparation that went into literally just walking around, to be seen.
My two closest friends lived in Kinnegad, so I have such kind of nostalgia for that time. Like I think back and it's quite like sweet, just like it seemed really like just like it seems so innocent now in some kind of respects, like we just hung around the street or the chippers or whatever, and you know, you did nothing, but you were never bored with this kind of like doing nothing, like you know.
No, it was Beckett level where I lived. and did you, I mean, would you sit at the end of the on the outskirts of town and look at the lights of Dublin in the far distance and think, you know, I want to be there?
No, but my mother worked in Dublin. She worked there 3 days a week. So I kind of knew of Dublin because of her commute. And then we would have gone up like, you know, every once in a while. I was aware that I was always going to go to college in Dublin, probably. And that was where, anytime you went to Dublin, you know, it felt kind of exotic and stuff. The cinema was better.
Yeah. Was there a cinema in Kinnegad?
The cinema in Mullingar.
All right, okay. How would you find if you could watch? Well, you know, this next track that's on your list I see here, my teenage years were several decades before yours.
Yeah.
But this is my teenage world. Where did you come across, because I came across this on Top of the Pops the first time. Where did you come across Thin Lizzy Dancing in the Moonlight?
I feel like this is a song that my friend's dad used to play.
Oh God. Wrong answer.
But it was, my friend's dad used to play a lot of music in their house, and I feel like this was one of the songs. I just love this song because like, I don't know, like you're kind of, I'm so used to like songs with lyrics about like, you know, like how much money the rapper is making and like what party and stuff they're going to. The lyrics to this song are like almost like profoundly uncool. Like he's getting the bus and like he's going to the cinema and like getting chocolate stains on him. Yeah. It's very sweet and I don't know.
This song, if I, you know, this song brings me back to those days of coming home from the cinema. Not in Kinnegad, but in similar circumstances, you know. Coming home, dare I say it, on my own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I should have took that last bus home, but I asked you for a dance. Now we go
stairs. Dancing in the Moonlight from Thin Lizzy, the choice of Nicole Flattery, who's with me in studio picking all the tracks. It's a great song, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's and you know, I know it's not a corny thing to say. It's said a lot. It doesn't mean it's untrue, but songs do transport you back to a particular place. That does for me. And it's interesting that, you know, many generations later it does the same for you. It does the same for you as well. We were just in the course of that talking about other writers, and at what point did you, as someone who was writing a bit yourself and getting into the swing of it and had a facility for it, start to read any other Irish writers? You had read Frank O'Connor, you said. Yeah. Anybody else?
Actually, when I was doing playwriting in college, I remember there was one day big excitement because Marina Carr came in.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's just, when she came in, the whole room was completely silent. Like, and we had to read out some of our work. And I think she said something to me like, good, or like just some like comment. And I was like, even that like little comment.
Of course.
Know,
well, like, from Marina.
Yeah.
You know, she's been in here doing this show.
Oh, she's fantastic.
She's wonderful, yeah. You know. And then, of course, similar part of the world, maybe.
In terms of, she's from Offaly. Yeah. And I remember reading her plays. I've read all of her plays, I remember, in like a 2-week period in college. And just being amazed, like this whole other kind of like world opened up for me. Just the way she thought about things. And like also like use that kind of landscape in a way that I had never seen before. You know, you sort of, you don't think the place you grew up is acceptable or interesting enough to write about unless someone does it before you. And she was definitely that. My dad was a big Pat McCabe fan.
Yeah.
So I read him quite early. And
did you read them all? Because some people read The Butcher Boy and I say, no, read The Dead School as
well. I've read The Dead School and I've read The Butcher Boy.
Yeah.
I haven't read some of the others.
But I mean, The Dead School, that's the one.
Yeah.
I think that's his best book.
Yeah, it's a brilliant, brilliant book. It's so funny. So, so funny. Like this, I reread it recently and I just was underlining massive sections of it, you know? It's great.
It's important, isn't it, what you say about, you know, Marina Carr? Because sometimes it takes writers like that to kind of show you what's under your nose or show you your own place.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's, I mean, how many writers are there from the Midlands at this point?
I feel like there's less from the Midlands and more from like Mayo. I feel like Mayo has a large chunk of them. But yeah, I couldn't tell you. There's a good few from the Midlands. We were just saying Mulaney, he's very good.
And is it inexhaustible, the material?
I think it is inexhaustible because I think one of the most important things for being a writer in some sense is being a little bit bored and like letting your kind of imagination like reach in that way. So like if you don't have a whole lot to do, not saying there's a whole lot to do, not a whole lot to do in the Midlands, but it helps a little bit.
It's our version of Texas, you know, which produces all these great songwriters.
Yeah.
And anytime I've ever interviewed any of them, I always say, you know, what is it about Texas produces so many great songwriters? And I remember one of them, Rodney Crowell, said, it's just that big old sky.
Mm.
So there's a touch of that in the Midlands, too. This, you know.
And also there's this idea that like, and it's the same for anyone that like lives outside a city. It's like life is happening elsewhere.
Yeah.
And you're just sitting there waiting for all of it to happen to you, you know?
Where did you think life was happening?
I thought it was happening in Dublin.
Yeah.
But then I got there and I was like, not fully sure.
Yeah. let's have your next choice. Yeah. Now, Roy Orbison, again, while absolutely one of the greats, is not of your vintage at all.
No.
So where did you find Roy Orbison?
He's my dad used to play him a lot. And actually, my dad rang me before this and he was like, which Roy Orbison are you doing? And we had a bit of a debate about it. And I said, I wanted to do Crying because I could mention David Lynch as well.
Yeah.
So there's some, I'm a massive fan of David Lynch. So then someone else I'd be influenced by. But yeah, so you know, I settled on Crying. Also, because it's such a sad song.
I know, but do you know the you do the Spanish version of Crying?
Yeah, from Mulholland Drive.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Maybe play this afterwards. I'll play it on my own show. I won't play it on yours. But this is Roy Orbison's version of Crying.
I was all right for a while. I could smile for a while. But I saw you last night. You held my hand so tight as you stopped
Crying from Roy Orbison, great song. The choice of Nicole Flattery is with me in the studio tonight. Do you know what's just occurred to me? We're nearly an hour into this and I haven't asked you about the music you were listening to. Isn't that strange? What music was there in the house?
When you were tiny,
yeah. When I was... Record player?
My memory of listening to music with my parents would be like long car drives.
Yeah.
My dad would play like Roy Orbison and those kind of songs. Yeah. And then my sister, depending on the age she was, would like argue with him. And then like she'd get to put her CD on for X amount of time.
Which was what?
Like, I don't know, like really going to embarrass her now, the Dawson's Creek soundtrack.
Wow. I thought you were going to say Duran Duran, but it's worse than that.
No, much worse. She was a very moody girl.
Wow. So did she become your spirit guide in terms of what to listen to?
Yes, she did. But then, like, I feel that, like, a lot of my dad's music and also, like, friends, like, families and things kind of crept in there too. And, yeah, so I feel...
So as a teenager... And not a goth, as you stressed earlier on. When you and your teenage pals were hanging around Kinnegad of an evening, what were you listening to?
You're glad I didn't bring any of those, like, choose any of those songs.
No, come on, just, it's okay.
Awful pop music.
We're all friends here, come on. What was it?
Like Britney.
Okay. I've now placed exactly where you're at, age-wise.
Yeah, yeah.
So Britney was the thing.
Yeah, oh, Britney was, yeah.
And what happened when you went into the local establishments for a boogie?
Well, then it'd just also be pop music, you know, like really bad rap, quite like terrible stuff, you know.
And what about?
But you thought it was really good, like, you know. There's a kind of a period when you're like 16 and you're going to like places you probably shouldn't be, and you're like listening to that kind of music, and like that kind of music like lodges in your brain too, because it's like you're not allowed, you shouldn't be there.
Now your next choice is Robin.
Yes.
R-O-B-Y-N.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember when this came out.
This is her most recent album.
Yeah.
Yeah. So last year? This year? This year, possibly.
Might have been the start of the year, was it? And Missing You. Tell me about Robin.
Yeah. I love her. And her music is like kind of like joyful, but also like quite sad. And I don't know. It just reminds me of like dancing with friends in a nightclub or something. So yeah, she's great.
And that's Robin and Missing You. The choice of Nicole Flattery is with me in studio. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more of Nicole's choices. Stay tuned. And this is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. I'm here tonight with Nicole Flattery, who's the author of Show Them a Good Time, a book published by Stinging Fly and Bloomsbury, and another book coming out on Bloomsbury is called Nothing Special, which will be out, should she ever finish it, in 2021. Nicole is with me in studio, picking all the music tonight. It's been good. So far, we've had Sharon Van Etten, Saint Sister, Amy Winehouse, Thin Lizzy, Roy Orbison, and Robin, and there's some crackers to come in the next hour. So look, we get you out of Kinnegad now.
Yeah.
Out of school. And where did you go then?
I went to Trinity and I studied there for 4 years.
And theatre and film,
yeah.
Now, the theatre bit, I've some notion about what you might be doing there. Mm. What about film? What film studies? I mean, how does that work?
I felt like it was a kind of odd choice even when I made it. Like, I was always really into film and I watched a lot of films growing up, but like I feel like as a teenager everyone watches a lot of films.
Well, you see,
I thought I had good taste in film though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You reckoned you knew something.
I think I did. Yeah. Like, I felt more confident about my taste in that than I did in like anything else. But
you know, people who are into film.
Yeah.
I mean, they've seen everything and they watch, you know, indie films from from Bosnia and they watch, you know, all the Japanese films and all that stuff. I don't know, maybe you had, but when you left Kinnegad, had you really seen many more movies than just had been on in the local cinema in Mullingar?
No, I hadn't seen a whole lot, but I thought I had. Right. And that was the problem when I got there and I met people that actually had seen a lot of films. Mm. But yeah, it was a great, like, it was very, I'm really glad I did it. It was very interesting. A lot of the theory around it was kind of tough and things. But
when you arrive at the course, is there an assumption that you have actually seen The Seven Samurai and all the rest of it? No.
They're pretty forgiving.
And do they show them to you there?
Yeah.
So what's the sort of typical day of a film study student?
God, I feel like I'm going to be doing them a real injustice if I do my own typical day. I remember I had friends like studying like architecture and like medicine and things, and you'd feel like, I'd be like, oh, I have to watch 3 films this week. They'd have these huge course load. But you'd watch films in the evening and you'd read like quite a bit about them and, you know, write essays, which I found really interesting.
What did you make of, say, for instance, you know, you'd grown up watching the big blockbusters come to the Mullingar cinema and all the rest of it. And then, you know, you're presumably watching films by Jean Cocteau and all that kind of stuff, you know. Now, that was never screened in the cinema in Mullingar.
And it's like a completely new language. Like if you watch a film like that, it's like, I remember the first time I watched a Godard film, but like I could not understand it at all, because like you're not taught that way by watching blockbusters. You almost have to train your mind by like watching several films like that in order to get and enjoy it and appreciate it.
Because, and how did you react though? Did you think, oh, hang on, I've made the wrong choice here?
Yeah, actually, there was one, we just screened something one week and I was like, I have made the wrong decision here. Like I should leave. But then after a while, you kind of get more into it. It's just, I guess, the way, you know, our minds are trained with like sort of mass entertainment. Everything moves so quickly, you know, like in a blockbuster where you have to kind of have to like slow down to watch something else.
Yeah.
You know?
And do you think this exposure to so many movies and many styles of movie has affected the writing? Because very often, you know, you'll hear, you know, for instance, even a band, U2, their music is always described as cinematic. Mm-hmm. And you read lots of novels and you go, well, this reads like a film.
Mm-hmm.
Probably because they want it to be turned into one in some cases. Yeah. Very obviously, you can tell. But in terms of you writing a short story, do you think any of that has fed into the way you work?
Yeah, I would think about certain films if I wanted to evoke a time period or, you know, a certain idea. I would watch like a film. I certainly would watch one if I felt I was getting stuck in something more than like read a novel rather than getting that kind of voice in my head.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I find it useful. I don't write a huge amount of dialogue, which for someone although I'm trying to write a bit more now, but for someone that thinks a lot about cinema.
See, the films that I love most, and I wonder, are they part of your course?
Yeah.
Were all those, you know, those noirs,
noir,
and they are all dialogue. I mean, cracking dialogue the whole way through, you know? Did that appeal to you?
Yes. And I remember I was thinking about a noir kind of setting for one of the stories in the book, actually the last story in the book, which has the most dialogue. And yeah, I loved all of those. And also they were sort of like, you know, when you go to college and you're like introduced to these sort of ideas, which I think feminism was like not something that I knew anything about in school. And these were sort of feminist in their own kind of like skewed way. You know, the woman would like come out on top, and a lot of like dark ideas, like incredibly dark ideas. Like I remember the first time I watched Sunset Boulevard and you're like,
that's very dark.
Very dark and like very strange and, you know, weird and
I'm kind of turning into her now.
I can't wait to turn into her.
But it really is worth watching those films again, you know. And the idea of film studies might sound stupid to somebody, but you could write a book on any one of those movies.
Yeah.
Your next choice, you may well have come across her first in a movie, Liza Minnelli.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell me about this. Maybe this time.
I just love that. Well, I love certain musicals and I love Cabaret, and this is my favorite song from Cabaret. And I think I love it because I think it contains, I like any kind of writing or anything that does this, but it has like two emotions. Like it's so sad, and then but it's kind of so joyful as well. You
know? Is that extremely, as a writer, is that extremely difficult to do? Is it?
I think so.
Happy and sad.
I think so, but I think the best kind of writers can do it, you know? Like, the song is, like, extremely melancholic and, you know, there's such a note of hopelessness, but then there's just that, like, glimmer of, like, possible hope. And, yeah, I just think she sings it beautifully.
And were you attracted by that world when you saw Cabaret?
Yeah, it's such a Republic, also kind of new. Like, the film is so modern, you know? Yeah, it's a great movie.
Okay, maybe this time Liza Minnelli.
Maybe this time I'll be lucky. Maybe this time he'll stay.
Liza Minnelli there, and a song called Maybe This Time, the choice of Nicole Flattery, who's with me in studio. When you were doing the film studies, Nicole, was it through that or around that time you started to return to the writing?
Yeah, I was mainly through playwriting. I think I wrote a screenplay. I did. It was part of our course. I left it very last minute, as it was college, and I wrote it in like one night. It was very bad, but it was fine, actually. I was like, did okay. I was like, oh, maybe I'm better than this than I thought.
But it never got made.
Oh, God, no. No.
And you'd written a play as well, is that right?
Yes, I did write a play, and that was staged. A friend of mine directed it, and we put it on in like the New Theatre, and that was a good experience, actually. But I didn't feel that I'm not a playwright. Like, I feel, you know, playwrights are incredibly skilled, and like to make something happen, it's hard to do, and I just don't feel like I have that particular gift. And you don't need to make anything happen in a short story. You can just have a lot of atmosphere, you know?
Something has to happen.
Yeah, that's
once.
True. I feel like something has to happen in a novel, which is going to be a real issue for me.
We'll talk about that. I want to leave that to the end. So is that when you wrote what might have been your first serious short story, if you know what I mean? I don't mean serious as in you haven't been writing before, but you kind of decided to kind of, well, let's give this a real lash.
I did a master's in creative writing then in Trinity, and I started writing short stories then seriously. I wrote like 4 or 5, and yeah, they were fine. Like, you know, I wasn't particularly skilled, and I didn't feel that I knew what I wanted to write about. Like, I was like 22 or something, you know, like, but I kind of learned a lot about the form and things like that.
There's two aspects to that, and I want to look at. You say you weren't that skilled at it. Did you become more and more skilled with the criticism and just by doing that course?
I felt like I did, actually. I know there's a kind of like debate about that, like, you know, whether you should do. Yeah. You can't teach writing, and I don't think you probably can, but I do think you can help someone get better and sort out the muddle that like is in their mind, you know?
To be around some sort of rigor is no harm.
Yeah,
you know?
And to be around people that like, you know, talk about books and are passionate about books, like that's useful.
Yeah.
You find good readers. So I do think I became a bit better there. And I found it helpful.
But the other part of it then, the second thing you said was you're only 22 and you didn't have anything to write about.
No.
I think that's the more interesting side for most writers. I mean, there's lots of people out there can write, but they don't really have anything they want to write about or anything much to say.
I was just like grasping at like straws. Like, I worked in a card shop at the time. I was just like in town and I was like, write about the card shop. And I was like, who wants to read a novel about a card shop? You know, I just didn't have anything. And I was also like kind of aware that, like, in the way that like lots of young women do, like just dismissing my own experiences as in like, that won't be interesting. Like, you know, you don't feel like you have anything worthwhile to give. But then again, I will read almost anything regardless of the content, if it's written well or if it's funny or, you know.
I mean, there are now, and it's a great thing, there are more books by women who write about, not necessarily novelists or short story writers, but write about just the experience of being a woman.
Yeah, and I think that's fantastic.
There was nothing like that around when I was younger, you know. I could have done with reading it. But, you know, it's useful to read.
I even feel there was like not a huge amount of them even 8 or 9 years ago.
I don't think so. But it's interesting what you say. You would have felt that your experience was of no value or no consequence, not worth writing about.
No, absolutely not. And I was doing that terrible thing that I feel like every like Irish writer will admit to doing, you know, like I was reading like John McGahern and like I was being like, had to be like rural, it had to be miserable, and it couldn't be like, in order for it to be serious literature, it couldn't be funny, and it couldn't be this, that, or the other. And like, it took me a long time to kind of shake all of that. As much as I admire like McGahern,
of course, yeah.
But you're just so because Irish writing has this huge history, you feel so indebted to all these people, and it's hard to escape that, you know.
But that different kind of writing is now available.
Definitely.
To people, you know.
Yeah, I feel like it's opened up so much, even in the last like 5 years.
It's that expression. It still sounds odd to me, though. She writes on the body.
Yeah.
You know, that's the expression that's used, you know. Why is it not about? But it's also writes on the body. And that phrase is now so familiar now. You don't question it, yeah. So you say you didn't have anything to write about.
Yeah.
When you wrote a story for the White Review and won a prize and so on, what did you land upon where you thought, I could write something about this?
Yeah, but that story was interesting because I wanted to write about a comedian for ages. Because I like comedians and I like going to see comedy and stuff, but I find them like interesting figures, essentially.
Yeah.
And then,
did you know any comedians?
I know a couple of aspiring comedians, but I don't know any serious comedians.
Yeah.
I wish I did, and then I bet if I did, I'd be like, oh, I wish I didn't.
Yeah, but what about writing about what you know?
Mm.
You're writing a short story about a comedian.
Mm. I didn't really know that, but I did. I lived in New York for a while, and I did know that kind of. Environment almost, you know, like the environment I'm writing about in the story. And I wanted to write about that almost as a way of like, you know, working through something like that.
And when you fired that into a competition, White Review competition, did you forget about it? Did you any hopes whatsoever?
No, I actually didn't. And I entered and I remember I emailed and then I actually have a bad memory and I forget that I do things a lot. And I went then for like a cup of coffee and I think I'd already forgotten about it by the afternoon. So like when it happened, I was like, oh, good, that's great.
And that would have garnered quite a bit of attention, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I remember being like, it was exciting. Although like I had stories and things published, I felt, not that I feel, I certainly don't think people need to win prizes to feel like, you know, worthwhile. I don't agree with prize culture at all, you know.
Yeah, but it seems to, it seems to work as far as the people with the money are concerned.
Yeah.
I mean, they'll take a look at you if you've won a prize.
Yeah, and there was that. There was a lot more kind of more attention and kind of stuff like that. And I have read that story in public and stuff, and I haven't reread it in a while. And I feel like I was in quite like a different place when I wrote it. Now, so I don't know how I would feel about it now, but yeah, I'm glad it won me some money.
you mentioned New York. Let's talk about New York after your next choice, which is Talk About New York. This is from Songs for Drella, which is an album that Lou Reed and John Cale made for their old manager and mentor and pal Andy Warhol. We'll talk about this after we play the track.
I look like I do not since I was shot.
And that's Lou Reed and John Cale together, Nobody But You, from the album Songs for Drella, which is the choice of Nicole Flattery with me tonight. Nicole, you mentioned just in passing there that you spent some time in New York. In what circumstances and for how long?
I just went for a year and on a graduate visa and just kind of lived there, worked there, did like several different jobs, as everyone in New York does. It was really enjoyable. It was kind of defining, I feel like, in some way. Like I could definitely like split my life into like before and after in some respect. But
well, it has that effect.
Yeah. I lived in Brooklyn and like just like 9 months in, I was kind of like, I haven't seen a baby or like a person older than maybe 45 in like 6 months, 7 months. Like you're just living in this like total bubble, which I just don't think, like, I don't think is an incredible healthy way to live your life.
Well,
you know?
I was in, the last time I was ever, which is exactly 3 years ago, on the east side, Alphabet City, down in Alphabet City, which was when I went there first, you just didn't go there.
Yeah,
I mean, if you did, you dipped your toe in and then you turned and left quickly. people out walking poodles.
Yeah.
You know, really bizarre.
Yeah.
No, I'm not advocating, you know, that I'm not suggesting things were great when it was dangerous and extremely dangerous in places, but it is commercialized and every block's the same now.
Yeah. It everything used to does be look very the same.
Used to be every block was different. Yeah. Every block was an adventure of its own. But anyway, when you were there, did you spend much time in Manhattan?
I did. I worked in Manhattan for a while.
What'd you do?
I worked as an assistant to a literary agent.
Oh. Well, here, discuss.
I wrote an essay about it for the Stinging Fly, actually. Right. If you ever feel like reading that. I got quite brutally fired.
Why?
The combination of being incompetent and...
insubordinate, I hope.
And, yeah, insubordinate. And she was quite a scary woman. She was... It was a defining experience, I thought, for me.
So you've got sight of the other side of the publishing business then, which
And I think that kind of not cynical. I didn't go in with a certain amount of cynicism, but I did go in with a little bit of guardedness, you know, because I was aware of that. You know, it operates like any other industry. You know,
I think it's worse than the music business.
Yeah,
actually, if such a thing's imaginable. Yeah. I think it is. I mean, you already said earlier on, you know, you don't like prize culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, at a certain level, it's a ruthless business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is so far removed from your sitting in your room writing your short story, isn't it?
Yeah. I think, like, it's good to see, you know, well, definitely always good to see the assistant side of it, you know, like that there's, in my experience, I felt that there was just women like me, like who I never met, like operating in like all these publishing houses and literary agents all over the country, and like, you know, just trying so hard to please their bosses, and like taking like 20 minutes lunch to like eat their salads at their desk or whatever. And like, once you see that, it strips away a certain amount of glamour, you know.
Yeah.
I think that's good to have that.
And you feel that you have to do that in order to.
Oh, in New York, there's no choice, you know, and that kind of work culture. I found quite repellent.
And there's nothing worse being in a really exciting city and you can't get to enjoy it.
No.
And what other jobs did you have when you were there?
I worked in a bar for a while.
How was that? I suppose it depends on the bar, really, doesn't it?
That was fine. I worked in bars before, so I didn't really felt indifferent to that. It's the same as anywhere.
Okay.
And I worked in a publishing house as well.
And what did you do in the publishing house?
That was good, actually. That was interesting. It was an independent publishing house, so I read a lot of manuscripts and... reviewed them and things like that.
So you're starting to think to yourself, I can do this.
Yeah. And actually, that's the best thing. I do you know Tom Morris? He used to work with Listening Flight. I think that's the best thing. It sounds kind of not. I don't mean to sound dismissive of other people's work, but you suddenly become aware of like the standard and like the actual standard, and like it's not lofty of like looking at people's, you know, best selling book like Margaret Atwood or whoever in the bookshops. You're like suddenly aware that like this is something I could actually try, you know, and like not embarrass myself. And even if I do embarrass myself, lots of other people are embarrassing themselves. Yeah. So it's like not too hard.
Your next choice, Frank Ocean.
Mm.
What have you got to tell me about Frank? It's the second time Frank Ocean has been picked in 3 weeks, I think. Yeah, it is.
I just love Frank Ocean. And I'm obsessed with him in like a small kind of way, because I think, you know, like everything is like Instagram and like Twitter, and like in this kind of day and age, you're expected to give so much of yourself away. And I think he's one of the rare, incredibly like successful artists who's given very little of himself away. And even when you see photos of him, it's like he just seems private. And then like,
and he also, a bit like Lou Reed, sings in characters.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
So even though, you know, what he's singing is not necessarily him.
Yeah, I just also think he's like genuine. I saw pictures of him at like a Met Gala a few years ago, and he just looked so uncomfortable, and that endeared me to him.
it would make you.
Pool side convo about your summer last night.
Oh, about your summer last night.
Didn't give you no play. Could I make it shy last night? Could I make it shy on the last night?
Last night.
Could we make it in? Do we have time?
Be the boyfriend in your wet dreams tonight.
And that's Frank Ocean there on Self Control. Nicole Flattery with me in studio picking all the music tonight. So Nicole, you know, even though you'd seen a certain side of the publishing business in New York, you were happy enough to offer yourself up to it on the other side.
When I was writing, I never considered it as being, I guess, you know, like I was lucky because the Stinging Fly are an independent publisher in Ireland, and that's who I would have been being supported by.
They're decent people.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Civilized folk.
Very civilized. And so it just felt like writing to me. I never felt, except towards the end of the book, when I was trying to gather the stories, then that felt like it was part of something bigger than myself, you know, actually like publishing a book rather than publishing in magazines and stuff like that. I never really thought about the industry a huge amount.
You're part of it now, though.
I am, yeah.
The reality for writers, full-time writers, mm-hmm. is like there's no money in this lark at all. I mean, okay, you know, the headline for you for a while is going to be hefty advance, blah, blah, blah.
Makes it sound, they also put it in a kind of dangerous way. It makes you sound like you've robbed someone.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, this, you know, that's going to be over a number of years.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, I mean, every good wish in the world, but there's no guarantee of anything afterwards.
No. And it's kind it's a dangerous sort of leap. And I feel like because the money is so, you know, like unfairly distributed in writing and things, like it becomes like something that's reported on, whereas like actors get huge amount of money for being in like films and TV shows, and it's not the headline for them, you know.
Yeah, but most actors get nothing at all.
Yeah,
barely anything. But and it also, I guess, you know, and what people will be thinking, well, it's all right for you. You've got your big advance, but the reality is, it puts you under certain pressure too, because if your book's not a hit, big hit.
I'll be hearing about it.
They're going to think, well, we're not giving her any money again, you know? And by that stage, some other writer from Kinnegad will have emerged.
They better not. I'll be watching.
Big league supplier of talent to the worlds of arts and literature.
I would be so annoyed. Westmeath.
Westmeath. They're queuing up in Westmeath.
I think it's a scary thing, though, to like know the people, you know, like if you're neurotic, which I tend to be, you know, that you could overthink that if they wanted to be a hit. Yeah. Like you could, like, you know, like go back through the last 10 years of publishing and be like, what are the biggest hits? Like, you know, like you see they do that in film. One film comes out and it's successful and then there's 20 copycats and like you just, it's impossible to know what's going to.
Well, have you been under any pressure in terms of, you know, we like your idea, Nicole, but that'll never be a hit. Write this one instead. Do you get a bit of that?
No, I've never had that. But I'd say if I went in there with like a totally like David Lynch, like abstract idea, like, you know, Andy Warhol should be like a talking tree or something, they would be get me like out of there, you know, and try and change my mind.
Can you say, is Andy Warhol part of the book you're writing?
He's on the fringes, but not in the actual book, I don't think. But yeah, you know, you could go in there with all these kind of, and I love reading books that do something different, you know, like that. You can tell I've tried something different.
Yeah, but as you can expect, to sell 6 copies.
Yeah.
and the business does not want those ones.
No, definitely not.
Next choice, let's get a few more tracks in. We've got, Julian Baker.
Mm.
This is good news. We were talking about this earlier. I'm not sure which of her albums this is from.
I think it's from the Sprained Ankle.
Sprained Ankle?
Yeah, okay. I think so. I actually saw her in Paris. She was great. She's a tiny little woman, the massive guitar. She's great.
You have the times of it.
I do. I have a great time of it.
You should put on your, you know, the author's bio in the book, you know. She divides her time between.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, I love when they have
She divides her time between Kinnegad, Paris and New York. Julian Baker there, and good news, the choice of Nicole Flattery. Nicole, so if anybody's listening now who writes, it's always good to hear something about a writer's process, you know. Have you a set time in the day? Do you wait for the muse? Do you believe in the muse?
I believe in the muse, I guess.
And what is the muse?
I guess a muse is like an idea. I wish I had like a specific like muse, like a person.
Well, Paula Meehan, the poet, believes the muse exists. Her muse is a woman.
Really?
And she can smell her when she's around the place.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's what she says.
Oh, wow.
So there you go. But you don't have any actual presence floating around the room or anything?
No, I don't. I know, though, if I have like a good idea and like I feel that like, and I'll think about it for a while and then I'll work on it. But I don't have like a set time, and I certainly don't now because I feel like I've been traveling a lot. But I can be quite, I will be quite rigorous if I have deadlines and things like that. So I'll ignore the muse and just be like, I have to work from this time to this time.
And if you get up in the morning and sit down and forget about muses and all the rest of it and just think, I've got to get this done by 3 o'clock, will you get it done? Or something done?
Anyone who I've ever missed a deadline for is listening to this now being like, no, she will not. I don't, like, I'm a big rewriter. I edit myself a lot and I cross out passages and I rewrite a lot. So I think I have a problem meeting deadlines in that respect. But if I will try, I will try and get it all done.
Do you prefer the morning or the evening? Late night?
Actually, I have a theory on this because I write quite a lot of, and certainly when I was writing this book, I was writing quite a bit of book criticism. So in the morning, I would work on fiction and criticism in the evening.
Right.
Because I feel like it takes, and critics probably listening to me be like, no, but I feel like it takes less. I think fiction is more difficult. It requires more thought. But I think, yeah, morning is better. If you can work in the morning without actually like looking at your phone or anything.
Yeah.
You just go straight
Yeah, straight to it. No interruptions.
No. Yeah.
And coffee, Mars bars, cigarettes?
Coffee, occasional cigarette. Definitely coffee. Couldn't write without coffee. I drink a lot of tea, like a lot of herbal tea.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that would be it, really.
Do you ever write with a glass of wine beside you?
Only if it's like really necessary. I absolutely need it. Like.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Doesn't help, though.
Doesn't help. And I'd say, like, one or two of those stories, I'd say you could almost pinpoint this, the part where I had the glass of wine. But not usually, no.
Yeah.
Clear mind is probably better.
And do you then, you know, when you finish a short story or you think you finished it, do you put it away for a long period of time before you had a chance looking at it again and saying, look, this is finished?
Yeah, I would. I would put it away for a while unless I have a really tight deadline.
Mm.
But that's the White Review story. I remember I finished it almost to the day that I sent it off because I just had to. But I do think there's a real benefit to, and even some of these stories, which I would have written when I was like a couple of years ago and then I went back and revised them for the book, that was useful. You know, it's good to have time away from it.
I like Kevin Barry's idea of putting them in a drawer and letting them talk to each other.
So you say that?
You wouldn't know what would happen.
I don't want those women talking to each other.
Your next choice, Young Fathers.
Yeah.
So you're very hip and trendy.
I am not hip and trendy at all, actually.
I love Young Fathers, actually.
Yeah, they're great. They are great. I saw them in October or something last year.
Shame?
Yeah.
That's Young Fathers and Shame. Nicole Flattery with me in studio tonight, picking all the tracks. We've still got time for a few more, Nicole, and we'll keep on pushing here.
Okay, great.
One question I didn't ask you about process was longhand or straight on to the...
Longhand, yeah.
Yeah, you write longhand.
I read everything longhand. It takes me ages. That's why I miss my deadlines. because I can't think when I type straight onto a computer. So even like essays or criticisms or even things that have to be in quickly, I would write longhand.
I wonder do many people do that? Longhand.
I don't know where it's come from because like I grew up with a computer.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I have a distrust of the actual like process of it. Like the keys, I feel like something in my mind doesn't agree with it.
You feel like you're making something when you're writing with longhand, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And then you have like the actual like results of, I can't read my own handwriting, but like when I sign books, people tell me it's terrible all the time. But at least I have it. Like I have a physical.
And then when you type it up, you're into a second draft already.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned publicity and touring and traveling a lot there. how do you manage with all that? I mean, do you like it? Do you like being interviewed? Do you like? Mm. I mean, this is different. I know there's people do this Sunday night program who actually don't do interviews at all.
Yeah.
And they're happy to do this because it's playing records. Mm. It's a different thing.
Yeah.
But when you're sitting down to your 20th interview about what's your book about?
Yeah.
It must get tiresome.
I think it's an interesting one because obviously, like, you know, part of you feels grateful for it, you know, that people are showing such interest in your book. But then, you know, the other part is, we live kind of now where you're expected to be open about everything and like talk about, particularly as a youngish, I'm aware that I turned 30, a youngish woman, that you're supposed to give all kinds of personal details about yourself away and, you know, write about things that I have no interest in writing about or talking about, experiences I may have had. So I find that sort of uncomfortable.
Do you think you ever would write about it? I mean, I don't know anything, but do you think you ever would? Because there is now, market makes it sound makes it sound sort of cynical, but there is now a demand, let's put it that way, for women writing about their experiences.
Their personal, yeah. I think I could if I found the right subject and I was extremely interested in it. I'm not hugely interested in myself. I find that I prefer writing about things that, like books or films, and things that I do better. But I love reading personal essays by women and their wonderful personal essayists in this country. And, you know, also like Jaya Tolentino, a writer for The New Yorker, who writes about like millennial. And, you know, I find all that stuff so interesting, but I don't think it's where my own strength lies. I think I feel too neurotic to do it. I think I would really overthink it.
No, I don't want to make you neurotic, but you have said neurotic twice.
Yeah, I have. Yourself.
Are you neurotic? Are you Annie Hall in the movie?
God.
Are you?
Not Woody Allen.
Well, I can tell you're not Annie Hall, but are you, what do you call her, Diane Keaton?
Yeah.
Are you her kind of character?
I definitely would overthink a certain amount of things. Like, I feel, you know, I wouldn't, if a certain subject came up on social media and some people respond so promptly, you know, they'd be like, this happened to me. And then, you know, they've got their 2,000 word essay out there, and I don't think I can do that. And it's not I don't really care about how I'm perceived, or I don't think it's a particular shyness. I just think that I would be thinking about it from like every possible angle, and like, I just don't know if I could do it, but maybe I will. You know, my next book won't be selling, and I'll have 20 personal essays out, each one more dramatic than the one before.
Okay. You heard it here first. Your next choice is Karen Dalton. She's terrific. And I love this. I love this. Something on Your Mind. Go. And Nicole just made a very perceptive point about that. I mean, that's Karen Dalton from a long time ago, but it could have been released this week because it sounds so much like a lot of the indie records that are coming out just now. Not just the music, but the voice and everything. You're right about that, actually, yeah. She's great, Karen Dalton. If you don't know Karen Dalton's music, check her out. Do you do social media?
Do
you recommend it? Not necessarily, well, first of all, for a writer, and second of all, for any human being.
I don't recommend it. I'm not a massive fan. I don't use Instagram.
Yeah.
And I do use Twitter, much to my regret.
Why do you use it? I mean, what purpose?
I actually only joined 3 years ago, and a friend of mine was like, don't join. And then I was like, why is he telling me not to join? Are they all having a great time on there? And then I did join.
They're all talking about you.
Yeah, I was like, So, because he told me not to, I did. I kind of use it to, like, post stuff that I've written or whatever, but I'm not hugely into it. And I also feel like, you know, you write something or you tweet something or whatever, and then you like check it and stuff, and that process just like does not feel good. You're like, how many likes did I get?
Yeah.
You know, and then like you reduce your writing to like, I recently wrote a book review, and like it was really interesting for me, and I learned a lot, and I was reading in around it, and then you're like, oh, my book review only got like 125 likes, and you completely disregard the process, which was like personal to you, of writing it, you know? So
it's a way of getting the word out.
Yeah, but I think beyond, you probably do that, need it. But
beyond that. And, yeah. you know, if you follow the right people, you can get a laugh out of it.
Yeah, yeah, some people are very funny.
Yeah, and you can get the news first.
Yeah.
But
the kind of weird version of the news.
Yeah, but other than that,
yeah.
do you know? Yeah, well, what happened? You get the news flash on Twitter and then you turn on the radio.
Yeah.
Do you know? You turn on the television or whatever.
But what you were saying, like, you just don't, no one on there is like they are in real life, you know? Like no one comes up to you and, like, announces themselves. Like, they announce themselves on Twitter. Like, yeah. like I won a prize or.
Well, you see, that's the thing. If you're for a writer, I wonder how wise it is to be on there, because most writers or most people are doing anything or struggling.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody's struggling.
Yeah.
But specifically because you're a writer, you know, you're trying to, you've got a book to write and you can't put two sentences together that day. You know, you're having an awful day or it's just been rejected. Yeah. Or
you see someone tweeting 3,000 words today.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, God.
And now I'm off to yoga, you know. 3,000 words today. Oh, and by the way, I'm delighted to announce I've just won such and such prize and I've in a six-way auction. And you go, like, well, these people shut up.
I know.
Because, you know, and you know, you feel like, you know, it can be very dispiriting.
Very dispiriting. And, like, then you also kind of, like, end up, like, getting caught up in it and feeling like not like you want to take part. And in order to like, contribute and take part, you have to adopt this persona.
Yeah.
I guess that I overthink it. I don't think that's good. It doesn't, like, contribute to any, like, real life relationships and things that I actually do have, you know?
Yeah. Do you remember those?
No, they're no good. I hate all my new real life friends.
We haven't a whole lot of time left, but I want to play your last two choices, Nicole. And this one needs no introduction. Modern Love from David Bowie. I said he needed no introduction, but Nicole actually wanted to give an introduction to that one. What was the
I just was thinking about, because you were asking about New York, and that is played in Frances Ha, which is incredibly, like, I feel almost, you know, very aware of myself when I say I really love that film and will always really love that film and will always cry when I watch that film.
Sometimes we like our guests to cry during this program.
Do you? Oh, I won't cry.
You're a massive disappointment to me.
I was told that I would cry during my master's and I never did. So not during this program.
Well, Nicole, thanks for coming in. It was great to have you in. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, likewise.
You know, writers can be tricky people. but it was great, and great choices in music. And you've one more.
Yes.
And Fleetwood Mac.
Oh, yes, yes.
So where and when? Where does this bring you, Fleetwood Mac, Silver Springs?
I was talking before about listening to my friend's dad used to play a lot of, like, music, and I remember he put on like being in a car with him, and he put on Rumours, and I just remember, like, I think it was like 10 or 11, being like, this is like it felt really adult, like that album feels like, so, if you haven't heard it before, like, it feels like something that you can't, like, express, and, like, just watching. I'd love to write about this, actually. Watching him listen to that album is like, but this song is, I don't think it was on Rumours originally, but yeah.
So, Nicole, Show Them a Good Time is your book of short stories, published originally by Stinging Fly, also published now by Bloomsbury. Mm-hmm. And your next book will be out in 2021.
Hopefully.
And it's called Nothing Special.
Hopefully.
Am I in it?
You're going to be in a net.
Great,
it's going to be a big DJ kind of section.
Nicole Flattery, thanks very much. Thank you
very much.
Thanks.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.